One of my favourite films in that genre is Argo. I don't know if you've seen it. Argo runs through, roughly speaking, a true story with a bit of kind of Hollywood embellishment of what happened to some American citizens back in the 70s. So they were living in Iran at the time of the Iranian Revolution. They were all working in the US Embassy. The US Embassy was stormed by Iranians. Most of them got trapped in there. But six managed to escape through a back door and ended up in the Canadian ambassador's house and kind of took refuge there. The problem is, as these Iranians had stormed the embassy, they kind of got hold of the documents that had been hastily shredded that showed how many people should have been working in there. And the film kind of puts two scenes together, one of these people staying in the Canadian ambassador's house, and one of kind of Iranian children working basically sweatshop conditions, kind of trying to piece these shredded bits of paper back together. The race is on. Are these six going to get out, or are they going to get hunted down? Back in the States, they're trying to quickly, hastily, come up with some kind of plan to get them out. They run through various options, basically none of which are really any good, and so they end up with the least bad option. What they do is they decide they're going to fake a film. So they're going to come up with this fake film called Argo, and what they do is they say, well, we're in the pre-filming stage, so we're just trying to hunt out for various locations. They put a backstory together, and then some CIA operatives, pretending to be a film crew, go to Iran pretending to look for locations for their new film. What they do when they're there is kind of scoop up these six people who are kind of hiding out in the Canadian ambassador's house, give them roles as part of the film crew, and manage to extract them from the country. And they do it literally just in time, with a few seconds to go as they're kind of being chased down the airport runway. That I'm pretty sure is Hollywood embellishment. I'm pretty sure it wasn't that close in reality. There's twists, there's turns, there's near misses along the way. But eventually those six get home. The main character, the one who comes up with this plan, the one who completes the plan, is a guy called Tony Mendez, played by Ben Affleck in the film. For his services, he receives an intelligence star, which is kind of one of the highest honours that an intelligence service operative can be given. Although obviously it's kept entirely under wraps, so you don't find out until kind of 25 years later that this ever happened. The main character is to be praised because he saves people from a hostage situation. God's people, as we come to Luke chapter 1, they're not hostages, but they're in a pretty precarious situation. Pretty unpleasant one. Here are some words. Verse 71. They need salvation from the hands of their enemies, from the hands of all who hate them. Verse 74. They need to be rescued from the hands of their enemies. And then verse 79. They're living in darkness and in the shadow of death. It's not a nice place to be, is it? That is the place that Zechariah and his people find themselves in. They're clinging to God's promises, promises that God made thousands of years ago, or hundreds of years ago, but they've had hundreds of years of silence in between. They're under a foreign rule. It feels like living in darkness and in the shadow of death. It's not a pleasant place for God's people to be. And just like in Argo, a solution is being hatched, or a solution comes to pass, and it's not the solution you'd expect. A solution on the surface doesn't sound like a very good idea. A baby. In fact, a baby before a baby is what we're going to see in these passages. Let's set the scene. Let's kind of catch up with where we are in the nativity story. Zechariah is mute. So if you remember back in earlier in chapter 1, an angel appears to Zechariah. Zechariah, who's really old. Zechariah, who, alongside his wife Elizabeth, have been barren. They've not been able to have children. An angel appears to Zechariah the priest as he's serving in the temple and says, you're going to have a son. And Zechariah doesn't really believe the angel. Kind of unsurprisingly, if you're that old, if you've not been able to have a child for that many years, probably not expecting it to come to pass. And so Zechariah is muted by the angel for his lack of faith. So you've got a mute Zechariah, you've got an Elizabeth who's about to pop. So that pregnancy did come to pass. We know that when she was about 5 or 6 months pregnant, her relative Mary came to visit her, stayed with her for 3 months. So the point at which we pick up the story, it doesn't take brilliant maths to go somewhere between 5 and 6 plus 3 is basically 9 months. The baby's about to come. That's where we're up to as we land in verse 57. And so in verse 57, the first thing we're going to see is a perplexing name. A perplexing name. Zechariah and Elizabeth have been through decades of grief, decades of shame and pain, decades of feeling inept and inadequate, decades of seeing friends and relatives have the joy of a little one in their family and not being able to experience it for themselves. They've had decades of people walking alongside them through their pain and suffering. And so, it's not a surprise that as the baby is born in verse 57, then in verse 58, there is joy. There is joy, both from Zechariah and Elizabeth and from their neighbours and relatives. They shared her joy. They've been alongside her through all this pain. A baby is born and there is joy. Wonderful joy. And then a week later, we hit the 8th day, the day that by tradition, Jewish boys were circumcised. And a circumcision ceremony is often when the name gets decided. So we get to naming day. The tradition of the time is that people are named after either their father or after a relative. And so they assume that this child's going to be named Zechariah. You've got to remember in this context as well, the likelihood of them having another child is pretty darn low. It's taken miraculous intervention from God through an angel to get one. This is their only chance to continue the family name. And so it's unsurprising that everyone expects them to go for Zechariah. They turn to Elizabeth. Elizabeth says, no, verse 60, he is to be called John. No, he is to be called John. So confused are they by this suggestion that they're not going to name the child after a relative or after Zechariah, that they turn to Zechariah for an answer. Zechariah obviously can't speak, so he picks up his writing tablet. I wrote on it earlier because I didn't want to try and write in chalk. And he says this, his name is John. Begs a few questions. Elizabeth knew he used to be called John. How did she know? Zechariah's not spoken to her. But I guess the writing tablet had come out at some point in the last 9 months as well. Probably multiple times to explain all that was going on. But Zechariah gets out the writing tablet and says his name is John. A perplexing, a puzzling, a surprising choice of name. They're not going to keep up the family name. No, they go for John. Why? We had a sneak preview earlier in chapter 1. Here's what it says in Luke 1, verses 13 and 14. I can't quite read. But the angel said to him, do not be afraid, Zechariah. Your prayer has been heard. Your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you are to call him John. He will be a joy and a delight to you, and many will rejoice because of his birth. That's why he's going to be called John. Perplexing and puzzling to those around them, but not to Zechariah and Elizabeth. Because this is what the angel said to do. The angel called on them to call him John, and so they do. And because Zechariah shows that he is faithful to this command that he was given, so then his tongue is loosed. See, this is no ordinary birth. It is miraculous. It's a miraculous birth to a couple who are barren and old. And there's a miraculous loosing of the tongue. As Zechariah suddenly speaks for the first time in 9 or 10 months. And so, it's not a surprise that those around ask this question in verse 66. What then is this child going to be? What then is this child going to be? Because he's not an ordinary child. And that's the second thing we see. A preparatory role. A preparatory role. See, Zechariah, his tongue is loose and he's able to speak. He's filled with the Holy Spirit and he prophesies. And his prophecy comes in two halves. First, speaking about the one who is to come, and then speaking about his own son, John. We're going to flip the order. First, then, a preparatory role. Because John's job is to prepare the way. Verse 76. You, my child, that's Zechariah speaking to his son, will be called a prophet of the Most High. For you will go on before the Lord to prepare the way for him. Those words are not insignificant. Here are words from Isaiah 40, a voice of one calling. In the wilderness, prepare the way for the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Zechariah knows his Old Testament. Zechariah knows what he's talking about. And when he says these words, he knows that they are the fulfillment of what God's people have been waiting for at least 700 years since Isaiah said these words. 700 years ago, when Isaiah promised that one day the Lord will come to bring an end to all of the hardship. The Lord will come to bring an end to all of the pain. The Lord will come to bring salvation. And that day is here, or at least the one who's preparing the way for that day is here. And again, this isn't a surprise to us, because we've had a sneak preview from when the angel spoke to Zechariah. He said these words earlier in Luke 1. He will bring back many of the people to the Lord their God, and he will go on before the Lord to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. Zechariah knows what's going on. He knows that this wonderful promise that they've been waiting for God to come to his people and sort out the mess, that promise is coming to fruition. And the person preparing the way is his son. Can you imagine how mind-boggling that must have been for Zechariah? The thought that what his people have been waiting for hundreds of years is coming to pass through his son. His son who is preparing the way. A bit like a warm-up act, preparing us for the main performance. The one who's there to get us ready, to get us not so much in the mood, but to reorientate our hearts, to put our hearts in the right frame to receive what God is bringing about. Do you see what John's role involves? Verse 77. Giving his people knowledge of salvation through the forgiveness of their sins. John's job is to convince us that we need forgiveness. To convince Israel back then that the situation they were in was not just bad luck, but actually the situation, the alienation they felt from God was primarily due to their sin. Their corporate sin as a people had separated them from their God. And so for us, well, they're separated by nature from our God. Our hearts need to be prepared for forgiveness. And that's what John came to do. Forgiveness is needed. And John also comes to convince us that this forgiveness is on offer because of the tender mercy of our God, verse 78. That phrase, tender mercy, quite hard to translate. Quite kind of, if you want to take it really, really literally, means something a bit like mercy from the bowels of God. It's a pretty graphic image, because in the first century mindset, the bowels, the deepest part of the human body, is where the deepest emotion came from. This is not just generic mercy. This is mercy from the very depths of God himself. God, as you plumb the depths of him, there is mercy at the bottom. Well, not quite at the bottom, because ultimately God doesn't have a bottom. Just heard that. cut that bit out of the recording. The depths of God don't ever come to an end. But as you dig down into it more and more, there is mercy. Anyway, let's keep pressing on. The difference between our situation, though, I keep catching people's eyes. He's like, I'm just going to look down. That's not that problem. The difference between our situation and the situation in Argo is that people in Argo, they are caught up in a situation and they are entirely innocent. We're not. And so isn't it wonderful that God shows tender mercy to his people? God shows tender mercy to his people. People who are complicit and culpable in the problem. John prepares the way by preparing our hearts, teaching us that we need forgiveness, and teaching us that forgiveness is available through God's tender mercy. And so John's role is to prepare us for that. His role is to prepare us. A perplexing name choice, a preparatory role, and thirdly, wonderfully, a promised salvation. We know from chapter 1 that Zechariah is a priest. He serves in the temple. And that means that he knows his Old Testament pretty well. And we can tell that. Because these words that he uses in this prophecy are so rich with Old Testament images and pictures and allusions. So rich. You can trace the Bible story, and most of it is here. Take you through some of the key events of the Bible. Genesis 12 and onwards, Abraham. The covenant God makes with Abraham, that promise he makes to Abraham to say, I will bless you. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars of the sea. The stars of the sea, the stars of the sky, sand of the seashore. I will bless you, I will give you a land to live in. Abraham's a key moment. And Zechariah says, the holy covenant, the oath he swore to our father Abraham, is being fulfilled in the baby who John is preparing the way for. Abraham. Next major event in the Old Testament storyline, the Exodus. Or verse 68. Those words, come to his people and redeem them, are words that are meant to cause us to picture the Exodus story. As God visits his people in salvation and his enemies in judgment. As he visits the Egyptians with plagues to free his people through a great act of salvation. Abraham, the Exodus, then verse 69. He's raised up a horn of salvation for us in the house of his servant David. Echoing famous words from 2 Samuel chapter 7. The high point of Israel's history in so many ways, as they're now in the land that God's promised them. They have a king over them who is one who seeks after God's own heart. They have David who rules and reigns. David who sits in his house and says to the Lord, I'm going to build a house for your name, Lord. And God says, no, that can wait. Because you, David, need to know that I am building a name for your house, a house for your name. That is, I am going to make your dynasty run forever. I am going to have one of your descendants sit on the throne forevermore. That wonderful high point, that wonderful promise of a king who will reign God's people from the line of David's, echoed here as a horn of salvation is raised for us in the house of his servant David. Then there are phrases that echo the Psalms, Israel's songbook, verse 71, salvation from the hands of our enemies, from the hand of all who hate us, echoing words like these. He rescued me from my powerful enemy, from my foes. He saved me from the hand of the foe, from the hand of the enemy. He redeemed me. Abraham, the Exodus, David, their songbook in the Psalms, and the promises of the prophets. We saw those words of Isaiah 40 fulfilled in verse 76. And then you get that imagery of light shining in darkness, picking up words from Isaiah 9, those famous Christmas words. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. Picked up by those, that idea in verse 79, to shine on those who live in darkness and in the shadow of death. All those major events in Israel's history, Abraham, the Exodus, David as king, their songbook, the prophecies of the prophets, all of them being picked up by Zechariah to say, all that you've been waiting for, all that your ancestors have experienced, that is coming to pass in the one who is to come. This salvation is a promised salvation. It's as if in this prophecy, in this song, major themes from throughout the scriptures all crescendo together. And so that got me thinking this week. Is there a film or in the final score, in the final kind of musical theme, all of the major themes that have come up to that point kind of crescendo together? I obviously had no idea, so I asked Jonathan. That won't surprise you. You can ask him afterwards. He's promised that he will hum you through all of them. But I asked him, and he said E.T. is a good example. So E.T., there were kind of five themes that happen earlier. And in the final theme, as you get that scene, all of those are kind of intricately weaved together into the final piece of music. There to show us that all that is past, all that has happened in this film has been leading to this moment. To bring all of those things back to mind as you see the end coming. And so too with these words of Zechariah. See, all those promises of the Old Testament, all those words were leading somewhere. And they were leading here. They were leading here. They were leading to the day when a baby is born, who is God come to earth, who is going to bring about a promised salvation for his people. A promised salvation that leads to his people serving him without fear, verse 74, in holiness and righteousness. You want to know what serving God in holiness and righteousness looks like? Well, Luke 1 and 2 have a few pictures of that for us. Because Zechariah and Elizabeth in chapter 1, verse 6, and Simeon in chapter 2 are described as those who are righteous before the Lord. People who have reached old age serving God faithfully. Not flawlessly, but faithfully. They are those who are described as being righteous. And so we too can serve him in righteousness, looking to pictures of that, like Zechariah and Elizabeth, who faithfully served God through the pain of childlessness. Looking to people like Simeon, who faithfully served the Lord, waiting for the day where he sees God's salvation finally coming to pass. A promised salvation that enables us to serve God without fear in holiness and righteousness. A perplexing name choice that reveals that John has a preparatory role, preparing us for a promised salvation, and finally pointing us to a praiseworthy God. Pointing us to a praiseworthy God. Look at verse 64. What does Zechariah do as soon as he opens his mouth? He begins to speak, praising God. Verse 68, one of the first words that come onto his lips as he prophesies. Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel. See, in Argo, Tony Mendez receives this star, this intelligence star. He is to be praised for what he's done. And so, in fact, so much more so, God deserves praise for what he's done. God deserves greater praise. Tony Mendez forms a team around him. God does it on his own. Tony Mendez's plan is a bit of a kind of botched last minute, let's wing it and see. God's plan has always been this way from eternity. Tony's trying to extract those who are innocent and caught up. God saves those who are undeserving and set against him. Yes, Tony Mendez puts his life on the line theoretically. Jesus willingly lays down his life, coming knowing that is always part of the plan. Not something to hope he avoids. I want you to think about those six people who'd got as far as the Canadian ambassador's house, whom Tony extracts, gets on a plane, and gets back to America. Here are their names: Joe and Kathy Stafford, Mark and Cora Leek, Lee Schatz, and Bob Anders. I want you to put yourself in one of their shoes as much as you're able, and to imagine talking to friends and family, and Tony Mendez's name coming up in conversation. How would you speak about him? It's blindingly obvious, isn't it? You're not going to denigrate him. You're not going to kind of be ambivalent to him. You're going to praise him to the rooftops at every opportunity. This guy put his life on the line to save you. You are only where you are because of what he has done. Without his bravery and foresight, without his ideas, without all he's done, you would be in a much worse situation. Isn't that so much more true for us? They would praise Tony to the rooftops. So we too, when we grasp what it is God has done for us, it is only natural that overflows with praising him. It's not time for me to stand here and guilt you into the times you haven't done that, because we all know that we don't praise God for what he's done for us as we ought. But actually, it's a natural overflow, isn't it? Zechariah didn't have to be commanded to praise. It's the natural overflow of seeing all that God has done for him and all that God is doing through his son, John. And so we too, the more we grasp all God has done for us in sending John and then in sending Jesus, we too will overflow like Zechariah with praise. Praise be to the Lord, we'll say, because he has come to his people. He has come to me and redeemed me. We know that wonderful rescue. And so we praise the praiseworthy God. We're going to pray together in groups. I'm aware that with masks, that's slightly hard to hear one another, but we're going to try our best. So turn in kind of groups of whatever is comfortable for you.